first, thank you for inviting me. It's my first ever trip to Canada, and it's, you can see lots of snow everywhere. So, okay, I'm going to start talking about new techniques for modeling gauge theory amplitudes. So, this is for a bunch of papers with electric collaborators. So, just to give you an overview of what I want to talk about, I first want to discuss why I'm interested in computing modeling amplitudes. So, I'm going to discuss how these are useful at QCD and also how they're beneficial if you want to investigate N equals A supergraph. And then I'm going to introduce the new method I want to talk about. This is basically going to be generalized unitarity, which is used to extract coefficients of one individual. Hopefully, at the end, you'll understand what I mean by that. And also on-shell recursion relations. And then, in the end, I'm going to just quickly discuss some of the applications of these new techniques and what we can do with them. So, let's begin. What's the problem? Well, one of the main big problems is the LHC. This is a big, expensive piece of equipment. We want to really maximize the potential of this machine. And so we really need to, you know, understand exactly what's going on there. So unfortunately, we started with a bang, and this is a picture of the effects of this bad solder joint. That's delayed the whole procedure until June 2009, which is unfortunate. But there's also a silver lining in the sense that it gives us more time to work on these wonderful packages. So basically, the idea is in the LHC, we want to find new physics. So we're going to try and probe beyond the standard model. This basically involves looking for events with missing ET and jet, for example. So obviously the standard model also has many processes that are very similar events. So the standard model is going to actually give backgrounds to these new physics searches. So as a quick example, this is a SUSY search, this was in the TDR. And the basic idea was you're going to have your background, you're going to have your nice signal here, it's going to be trivial to see something, it's going to be very exciting. The problem is, Pithia doesn't do eating order correctly. And so in the original background, it was easy to see. If you use RPM, which does do the leaving order three-level matrix elements correctly, you see the signal and background overlap. So if you're really going to be able to distinguish situations like this, we really need NLO computations, which means one loop. So what else can we do with this? Well, we can try and understand more about N equals 8 supergravity. And quite recently, there's been some three-loop, four-point perturbative calculations by these people here, suggesting that this may actually be UV finite. It's not nearly as divergent as you would naively think from just power counting. So it behaves almost like N equals 4 SUSY squared. So at one loop, this corresponds to what we call the no triangle hypothesis, which means the entire one loop amplitude is made up of just scalar box intervals. I'll explain that a bit in the end. And this is recently proved by this group here, and also subsequently proved again by putting some numbers here. So as I said, the one-loop amplitude is going to be made up entirely of scalar boxes. So what we want to do is we want to understand why this is much better behaving than we would have naively thought. And to give us a start to look at the hint of this, we can examine the one-loop amplitudes and see if they tell us something about why the structure of N equals 8 is the way it is. So we want to start computing one-loop amplitudes to do things. So the question is, why do we need new methods? Many, many years ago, Feynman showed us how to do one-loop amplitudes and tree amplitudes, obviously. So why don't we just compute Feynman amplitudes and get on with our job? Well, as an example, let's use Pasolini development to reduce a one-loop integral, which is just part of a one-loop amplitude, and see what we get. So we get something like this. Now, I've written it very small so that you don't get intimidated by the large sizes expression. And this is just one piece of term. So we can see that the structure seems to be very, very complicated. And basically, there's a factorial growth in the number of terms we get. And for example, if you wanted to compute things in QCD, so say six gluons, five gluons or something, then the state of the art really is 520s using Feynman diagram techniques. And we can see why. If we get to six gluons, we have 10,000 diagrams, seven gluons, 150,000 diagrams, and we can actually do these data amplitudes with an arbitrary number of legs. And this would correspond to an infinite number of diagrams using Feynman techniques. So this is clearly a problem. And you might say, okay, there's a lot of diagrams, but we have very powerful computers. Let's just stick them on a computer and compute them. Problem is, this doesn't work so well. Because these are like gauge-dependent quantities, they have very large translations between terms. This makes producing numerically stable code using Feynman diagrams very, very complicated and difficult. And people have been working on it, and there's been some progress, but basically, it's very hard. So the summary is, calculating using Feynman diagrams is hard.
So what do we actually need You're talking about LHC and flexible.
How many
legs do we actually need?
You need normally roughly the useful ones are about 6 points. Mm-hmm. So you want to say W plus 3 jets and things like that. So with the new techniques, we now begin to be able to compute these. And these are important for background. Basically, you'd like a large number of jets because this is a QCD environment. So, and if you're colliding at high energies, so you're actually going to get events with large numbers of jets out. So understanding the backgrounds of these is important.
Sure, but that wouldn't be the best way to look for new physics, definitely, right? Because it is such a complicated event structure that even if you get it calculated, you definitely want to stick to something much simpler and cleaner, like a clean resonance.
Well, I mean, the problem is the background is so strong that it's very hard to see these resonances. It's a very dirty environment because there are searches where you can look for resonances, but there are other areas as well. You can also use these for relating backgrounds. So, I mean, a lot of times they measure the backgrounds using actual data for one particular process they know well. And then you can use the calculation to relate this to the background of the event you're seeing. And you can also use these techniques to do that as well. Calculating ratios effectively. Thanks.
Can I ask another question? Mm-hmm. Why just nuance? Why do we have fundamentals in there?
Oh, that was just an example. Yeah, I mean, in general, you include quarks, and you can also include an electroweak processes like W's and Z's and that. The ones are actually the most complicated from the standard Feynman diagram point of view.
But there's no argument to say that this is going to be a leading.
No, in fact, the six gluons aren't all that useful in that sense. But they're a very easy proving ground to test these new techniques. It's more, because there's less particles involved and less field, it's much easier to work. And now we're moving on to actually compute with more different particles.
Suppose you have 10,000 diagrams. To what extent can you kind of eyeball it in group diagrams where you know there will be cancellations you were talking about, the cause numerical problems? I mean, is it really just throwing your hands up and saying there are 10,000 cancellations pop up almost randomly, so we can't simplify our lives by about many groups of diagrams and there's much fewer of those? Or
to be honest, I think probably not quite random, but I don't think we're just looking at I've never tried doing one of these calculations, but I mean, I know people have. And, I mean, you're doing it basically automatically. You don't write them all down, so the computer goes through them all. And you examine basically regions. When you track them numerically, you can test for regions that things called ground determinants, where these are going bad. And then you can try and use approximations to fix these areas. I mean, there are techniques you can do, but it does make the kind of calculation very slow.
Because I know in QED, people that do like state of their QED prove things like that, and then instead of saying that, well, there's clearly this factorial explosion of diagrams, the number of actual units you consider at each order grows much, much, much slower. QCD, I guess, it's much harder.
Yeah, I mean, I've not really tried this, but I assume I've tried everything they could. And, I mean, the thing is, you can do things, but you tend to get, it makes everything you have to do to make things simpler, makes the coding slower. So you want to stick these into calculating sort of NLO sort of generator of amplitudes. And you're going to evaluate these at 10,000 points. So if you take a long time to do this computation, it's actually not of any real use. So you really want this code to go as fast as possible and be numerically stable. So you might say to yourself, okay, that's the answer is just really complicated, there's not much I can do. But it turns out that calculating amplitudes are much simpler than you'd expect. So here are the two sort of classic examples, these are the Park Taylor. You can take a true amplitude with an arbitrary number of legs. If it's got just one, all the same velocity or a single different velocity, then it's equal to zero. Otherwise, if there's two negative velocity vectors, then it's equal to this simple form here. This is also known as the MHV or maximum velocity violating amplitude. And I've written this in spin helicity notation. So basically, the problem is with Feynman diagrams that they're gauge dependent and they contain off-shell vertices and propagators. So I think what we actually want to use is we want to just use on-shell quantities throughout. This removes basically these problems. So, what about gravity amplitudes? Well, from gravity point of view, these seem even worse. There's obviously Feynman diagrams from the origin. There's an infinite number of interaction vertices, for example, And so actually computing stuff would seem to be really, really difficult. And then in the, sort of, the 80s or early 90s, there's the Y-Wellman and Kai relation showed that gravity amplitudes could be related to simple to gauge theory amplitudes. And so the amplitude structure is actually much simpler than you would have naively expected. And because we obviously know from the previous slide that we can write these in very simple forms. And so these on this side, the three level amplitudes on this side, can be very simple. And so basically the simple gauge theory amplitudes mean the simple gravity amplitudes. In fact, even a couple of days ago there was a new paper describing a simple general form for writing n equals eight tree amplitudes. And so the question is, can we expose the simplicity of the amplitudes that we get in the final answer more directly in the technique we use to compute these things? And the answer is basically yes. So a key feature of all the new techniques I'm going to talk about is the use of complex momentum. And this is sort of a reawakening of an old idea, but using it in a bit of a different way. One of the crucial features of this that it allows is, for example, you can create an on-shell three-point function. Normally this would be zero using just real momenta. It's not possible to have momenta conserved and all three be on-shell. And the interesting feature about this is that you can then build, we'll see, you can build all of the tree amplitudes just on the three-point vertex. And for example, in gravity, just looking at the random, this would not be obvious at all. So there's clearly something interesting going on. We can also take better advantage of the analytic structure of the amplitudes. And so I'm going to explain what I mean by that right now. So basically, let's take an amplitude, and it's basically a function of its external momentum and velocity, and let's try and extend some momentum to the complex plane. So we do this by shifting the momentum to the external legs by a complex variable z. So this is the shift we use. We just take ki and make a function of this particular form. And we've done this in such a way that we keep both ki and kj on shell, and we also conserve momentum in the amplitude. And the, obviously, as I just explained, the important feature here is this is only possible in complex momentum, or you can use a different metric as well. And then you have real momentum, but it's in a 2q metric instead of 3-1. So what does this do? Well, here's a three amplitude. This is what it looked like before we played with it. Let's just shift it. And we see basically that we've added a pole to our amplitude. So what has this done for us? How is this of any real use? Well, we have a pole in a complex plane. Let's just use some simple complex analysis. The amplitude we're interested in is when z equals zero, so this would be at the origin. So let's just do a contour integral. And we find this nice simple relation that the amplitude is just equal to the symbol that we use inside the circle. So we know what the points for all those poles are. We know this because we know the factorization properties of the amplitude. So in the limit where one of the internal legs goes on shell, we get this sort of structure into two smaller tree amplitudes. So we just relate the two. That's straightforward to do. And we get this. These are the on-shell recursion relations. The basic idea is we build an amplitude with n legs from amplitudes with fewer than n legs. So we're sort of recycling the structure of the amplitudes. This can give us very compact analytic forms. Now, one key feature of this is that we need this contour at infinity to vanish. And now this depends on the theory in question whether it does or not. And it's actually proving this can be difficult for certain theories. And one of the most interesting things in fact for gravity was that this in fact for most shift does actually vanish. And it tells us something interesting about what's going on. So that was tree level, and I said I'm going to be talking about one loop. So let's look at the structure of a one loop amplitude. So we look at the analytic form of a one loop amplitude. It contains things like logs and polylogarithms. So these are objects with branch scripts, so it's a log time, some invariance of the external momenta. And we have rational terms, which basically just look like invariance of the external momenta. You get something like this, and the combination gives the loop amplitude. So what we want to do is, in the same way as we did for the tree level, we want to use a very efficient technique to either compute both pieces together or both pieces separate using whichever is the best way of doing this. So for now, I'm going to concentrate on just the so-called curve pieces. Let me introduce the one-loop integral basis. So I've been talking a little bit about this so far. So in the rational terms, which I'm going to ignore for now, and then we have this structure. We have basically box diagrams, triangle diagrams, and bubble diagrams. So these things are the scalar integrals. And these are the coefficients. And because we know that every one loop amplitude can be composed in this form, and just these pieces in four dimensions, we basically reduce our problem to actually just wanting to find what these coefficients are. So So how do we go about doing that? Well, we basically take the unitary cuts. So we basically replace any propagator with a delta function. So this is effectively the same sort of gluing together tree amplitudes. And so we're going to see how we can get an efficient technique out of this, because if the tree amplitudes are simple, the cuts will be simple. Basically, the idea is you glue together tree amplitudes. Introduced by Berlitz and Rumbaugh and Hasselhoff. The basic idea is that there's an underlying fiber diagram representation, so we know what's going on. So as I said, we're going to get compact loop results because the internal tree amplitude is compact. So the basic idea is we relate the products of good amplitudes to the net basis structure, and we can compute the coefficients of the integral basis. Obviously, this only computes subjects with branch cuts. And we have normally compute trees in just four dimensions. And so we're going to be looking at objects with cuts in four dimensions. Unfortunately, this means that we miss rational terms doing it this way. It is possible to do d-dimensional cuts, which I'll explain towards the end of the talk, where you then actually will include rational pieces in the computation. So let's look at the use of this. So we actually want to go one step beyond just doing normal unitary cuts. We want to use what's called generalized unitarity. We're going to cut the amplitude more than two times. And to give an example of this, I'm going to use a very classic example of calculating box coefficients. The basic idea is you have a quadruple cut on a box. So you have the four corners of the box, cut each of the four legs. So in four dimensions, you have four integrals, you have four delta functions, so you have four constraints on L. So you can completely solve for L. And you view, for example, where one is an asterisk, and you get a very nice solution for L. You then just simply substitute values of L, four amplitudes, and that gives you your amplitude, that gives you your coefficient. It's very straightforward and simple to do, involves very, very little work. And as I said, the importance of complex momentum here is this, in general, these constraints that you get from these things can only really be solved with complex momentum. And so this extra freedom we have by doing this allows us to compute things in the past we couldn't really do. That was the boxes, but you also know there is bubbles and triangles. So what about computing those? Well, we saw that a quadruple cut solved a box. So let's look at a triple cut. Will that give us a triangle? But if we look at, we cut an amplitude with three cuts, we see that what it does, you need to isolate a single triangle. We also get a sum of boxes that have the same cut. So it's not looking as nice. We can go further, we can look at a bubble. So we do a two-particle cut on this, so we isolate a single bubble. We now get triangles and boxes that have the same double cut. So basically, we have extra coefficients sort of mixing in with the cut. So if we just do a double cut, we have to somehow disentangle these coefficients. So how do we do this? Well, many people have tried in the past, and there are various techniques that all work and give you things. Some work faster and better than others. So one of the more recent and more popular things is what's called the OPP method, where you have a general structure for the integrand in terms of structures that can appear, and most of the terms in which are greater than zero. Then you just solve these coefficients. This is the OPP method. And I'm going to talk about what I call the live parameter, extracting the live parameter behavior of the integrand, or like direct extraction, which is a method which is reasonably closely related to this. So how does this work? Well, basically, we start by applying triple cuts to the integrand. We then parameterize the loop momenta in this special way. The key feature of this is these variables, k1 flat and k2 flat, are massless vectors that are constructed of the K1 leg and the K2 leg, massive legs in this case, or they can be massless by themselves. And the idea is that this vector going into K1 or K2 equals zero. That's going to be important. We take this cut parameterization and we put it into our cuts. And we ask ourselves, what can we do with this? Well, we know the general structure of the cut integrand. This is related to the OPP approach. It's given by this. So you have a bunch of terms proportional to T. The maximum power of this depends on the type of theory you're dealing with. Most renormalization, renormalizable theories like QCD, that goes up to 1003. And we have terms that look like this. So the question is, we basically just want to relate the two. So how can we do that? Well, the most obvious thing is we basically just want to discover it. So we just do this by series of timing around T goes to infinity. Now we'll get rid of the pieces we don't need. So we do that, and we end up with something like this. The important feature here is that the integrals over T do vanish, and therefore don't contribute to C0. Don't contribute to the triangle coefficient. And so we can then drop them can see that we just get C0 times the basic scale integral that we're interested in. So we've basically extracted the triangle coefficient simply by doing this expansion in T and dropping all the terms that depended on it. So that was an analytic approach, and that works very nicely if you want to do an analytic approach. But as I said earlier, we're interested in sort of numerical approaches, automating these things. So we want to do this thing on a computer. So a computer taking the infinite limit is actually not very straightforward to do. So we want to modify this approach for numerical implementation. So we take the same structure again. But now we consider, instead of before, we consider it as a contour integral in terms of a single and constrained parameter t.
Can I ask what programs are used for this implementation?
Oh, this, so I'll talk about this at the end. This is, we've written our own program in C++ we call Black to do all of this. So the idea is that you look at this on a complex plane and you see that there are poles. And this is about half the term. So you see that a pole basically corresponds to a term and an additional propagator, which we're going to associate with a box. So these pieces are box terms, basically. And so that we see that because we know how to do these with quadruple cuts, we can compute these d coefficients, which are the box coefficients. We know where the location of the pole is. So the basic idea is we can subtract these box terms off. So we're left with a structure that looks like this. And we're able to basically wipe the complex plane of poles. Then we subtract those box terms, and we want to extract C0. The most obvious thing to do when you've got a series like this is to just do a discrete Fourier projection to extract the coefficient. So we replace the contour integral with just a bunch of points that we can feed on, and that gives us the triangle coefficient. And that's very straightforward to program into a computer, and it makes a very nice, efficient procedure. So what about bubbles? Well, bubbles are slightly more complicated. We have a slightly different momentum parameterization, but we do exactly the same thing. We do a bubble cut. In our special momentum parameterization, we find with two free parameters now, y and t. And so we series expand these around infinity for y and t. So we see we have equivalent, sort of two equivalent pieces. We now have these terms, and then we have extra terms which contain basically an extra propagator. So we do as we did before. We see what integrals vanish. We see the integrals over t vanish. Basically, we can drop these pieces, and this one here. So that just leaves us this and this piece. Integrals over y, though, do not vanish. But it's very simple to relate the integral over y to just the scalar integral. So we can simply rewrite what we want here, like this. And so just by finding that these three coefficients, we appear to be able to complete the bubble. So the question is, this is the complete bubble coefficient? The answer is actually no. If we look at this, we see that it doesn't actually vanish from t and y to infinity. And that there's actually a little bit left over that we also must include in the bubble. So how do we see this? Well, as we use our previous calculation, we have a triple cut over a propagator. So we know the triangle pieces of this are given just by this form here. So these are the 1 over t pieces, these are the t pieces. We've previously computed this, and we basically know everything here. We want to change the t that was in the triangle parameterization to the t that was in the form parameterization. So we do a simple change of variables like this. And we see that the numerator now depends on y and t as well as the numerator. So if we take the infinite limit of y and t, you see that we have something left over. And we can work out what this form is. It's very simple, the general form. And so all we need to do then is combine this with two particle bits that go with the bubble by just plugging in the c coefficients of previously ordered features. So how do we do this numerically? Basically, we do it in a very similar way as we did for the triangles. We have a contour integral again. Integral over y is a real integral around this range. We see the poles corresponds to additional propagators, and the additional propagators basically triangle box terms. So we subtract these pieces we previously computed, do a discrete Fourier projection over these. So we can subtract this. It's a slightly more complicated form, so we need to evaluate y at 2 points, the pieces from y. But that's basically it. The question is, how does this? What can we use this for? So,
can I ask a question? Are those coefficients, say, process dependent, or they are just somewhere
for the C and yeah, they're process dependent. You have to compute them separately. There are are some people have produced some general formulas for these things, but they're very complicated. And it depends on the process that you're doing. So I'll talk how we use these for UCD later. But for now, I'd like to give you an example in gravity. So an example would be the scaling of trees in gravity. The scaling of the one that's integrated in gravity, I should say. So from standard power counting for one way triangle in gravity, you'd expect it to be something like this. It depends basically on the number of external legs. So as you add more and more legs to your process, your amplitude seems to be getting worse and worse behaving. So we can use this technique to actually see what is the maximum power of L that we expect in the numerator, and is it as bad as we think it is? So, as you saw, because we relate L to parameterization in terms of T and T and Y for bubbles, we can just examine what the maximum power of T and Y is. So I and some collaborators discovered that we relate the scaling of T and Y through level amplitudes. And so because we're plugging trees, we can plug in our parameterization there, see how they're scaling T and Y. So depending on the L's cut rates that go in, depending on the list, you can get different scaling behavior. You basically have to get T squared, T to the minus 6, or T squared in the triangle. This is something we only demonstrated at 10 points. This wasn't a complete proof, and you can check that this existed to all of this. So you can see from this that the worst behaving triangle you'd ever expect to see goes as T to the 6, when you take T squared, T squared, and T squared. So basically we say the maximum power of value here is 6. This is much better behaved than this example here. So the question you ask is, what's going on? Well, we can go a little bit further and ask what's going on in N equals 8 supergravity. Now, for N equals 8, we find that basically a super, we find there's a, that should be, there's the minus sign is blended in with the T. So that's T to the minus 1 for every degree of supersymmetry. So when you have 8 degrees of supersymmetry, you find that T to the 6 times T to the minus 8 gives you T to the minus 2. Therefore, you find that there's actually no triangle contribution at all. This is confirming the sort of no triangle hypothesis. And interestingly, we can see that the scaling of T, because we put it into a tree level amplitude, can be related to the scaling of Z, the on-shot restriction. And so, what is this telling us? Well, it was discovered by these people here that the boundary gravity amplitudes converges. So if you just look at the Feynman diagrams, mainly of the tree level amplitude in gravity, you think, well, you know, this is going to be, the large Z behavior is going to be bad, and you need that UG behavior is bad. So it's just going to be a mess. But you can work through, you can prove that the scaling of this boundary chart goes up to minus 2, 6, minus 2, minus 2, depending on which leg you shift. This is significantly better than you'd normally expect. And so basically what this is telling us is that because the trees are very well behaved, and usually so, then the behavior of the loops inherits this very good behavior. So whatever's going on here in gravity that's helping us is there's a hint of it coming from the trees. And so many people have looked at this, and there'll be many papers including my people here. In fact, there a related technique to this was used to completely prove the no triangle hypothesis. And it was also proved by Ferris and Bohr and Bateau using a completely different approach. That was an application for gravity. But there is more to a one-loop amplitude than just cut pieces. So what about directional pieces? Let's re-examine again the one-loop amplitude. And this time we do exactly as we did for the trees. We consider shifts of the external legs. So we basically set up from the same point, but now it's one loop. We perform exactly the same shifts, and we look what happens on the complex plane. So we finally have poles. Now we also have branch cuts. Then we do our contour interval. We find that we can deform our contour around these branch cuts. So we see that the pole terms will again correspond to basically onshore recursion relations. This time we have amplitudes and rational pieces, and rather than just amplitudes and amplitudes. And as before, the branch cuts we'll see can just be directly related to the cuts that we already discussed. And obviously, the sum of these two pieces gives us A0, which is the distribution at the center of the complex plane. So we can construct these things using onshore recurrence relations, or as I'll explain as well, d-dimensionally inherited. this is a new approach that's been gaining popularity in the last year or two, and unitarity techniques for computing these pieces. So how did the loop on shell recursion relation start? Well, we want to compute a rational piece. This is purely rational. So we're going to split it up into three pieces. We have trees times the rational on one side, rational times tree on the other, and then tree times tree with a factorization function in the middle, which is basically the loop being in the propagator. So as before, we basically summed over all factorizations of the rational pieces of the loop amplitude to find this structure. And we find that actually in general, the boundary term coming from this doesn't actually vanish. And you might think, okay, this is a problem. We have a boundary, what do we do with it? But the boundary term is also just a rational function. And in fact, it's very simple or straightforward to show that using just a secondary recursion function, we can actually derive this boundary term, very straightforward to do. And so when computing amplitudes of one loop, it's very hard to avoid this, and like a tree level where it's very simple to avoid. So we generally have a pair of recursion relations, one's going to be these pieces and one's going to be this piece. Now you might say, okay, is this everything that's there? But it turns out, because we have branch cuts in there, things more complicated, this is a complete rational result. We're missing what I'm going to call spurious poles. What are spurious poles? Well, as before, I said we have the amplitude, and it's split up into cut pieces and rational pieces. So here you have some of those poles, and here you have the branch cut. So we find that poles exist in C as well as just branch cuts. For example, you could take this one as example, or for example, if a logarithm times the factor, you shift it to Z, you find you have this. But, which corresponds to poles, because the logarithm doesn't vanish when this goes on a shell. But these correspond to poles that aren't related to any factorization. They're spurious poles. And in fact, if you look at the whole rational answer, you see these poles don't actually exist. The question is, what's going on? Well, we know that they don't exist in the prime and rational place. So they must be cancelling out in some way. And so it's straightforward to extract all of these poles and add them to the final rational piece by just computing those using the cut pieces. Now, the crucial feature of doing this is that you have to know exactly where all the poles are. And it turns out they're basically just related to the vanishing of shifted grammar terms of boxes and triangles. And so numerically, it's very straightforward to simply just go through pole by pole, computing these things using the new cut techniques we have for extracting the coefficients. That's a very quick overview of how we compute stuff using the on-shell recursion relations formula. But you could also consider going back and just using a single technique to produce these things, so d-dimensional unitarity. Now, in the past, this was difficult to do, and because obviously the amplitudes of the loop have to be in extra dimensions, and 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, because the amplitude we're looking at really is dimensionally regulated, and given in terms of d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon. So basically what we find is the Cook coefficients basically now depend on mu squared, which is the scale you get for these extra dimensional pieces. So we start off from our previous expression, the 4 dimensions, which is like this, and we see that we rewrite it like this. We find that the sort of bubbles now depend on the mu squared, the triangles depend on the mu squared, the boxes depend on it. And we can also have, because we're no longer in just 4 dimensions, we can also have potential contributions from the pentagon, which is normally scale proportional to epsilon. So they vanish in the 4-dimensional limit. So how do we go about using this to compute anything? Well, the basic idea is we want to relate the mu squared dependent parts of the coefficients to rational terms. So for example, if we took a triangle, we see that we have this structure here. So when we expand this out in terms of the mu squared, we see we have just a normal coefficient times a normal scalar triangle integral, which we had before. We have a new coefficient multiplying the integral with a factor of mu squared in the numerator. And it's very straightforward to then this integral and this integral and see that in fact it doesn't contribute as a curve. But in the limit as epsilon goes to zero, it contributes simply as, in this example, minus a half. This is going to give you rational pieces. The idea of d-dimensional unitarity is we want to extract some additional coefficients, which are basically proportional to mu squared. And we can do this in exactly the same way as we did with the cut terms. We just have more pieces to extract, so it's slightly more complicated and time-consuming. But it works quite well. And so these approaches have been implemented numerically by Gil Kunzmeller Kaufman. The OPP people did something, Simon Badger also did a related technique. It does effectively the same thing. Let's de-dimension the interactive. Let me move on to sort of the final little bit piece of my talk. Actually gone incredibly fast. We're going to finish the evening soon. And the basic idea is automation. So, as I said, there are a large number of processes to calculate for the LHC. And we don't want to sit down doing these things. It's not very interesting. Once you've done one particular calculation, the next one is very similar. It just gets very tedious. So you want to automatically, an automatic procedure doing this is highly desirable. At the moment, people calculate one of the advantages of QCD basically like this. They spend years learning this skill. They become very skilled, careful artists and artisans. And then you carve out the amplitude very carefully. You produce one, you plug it into something, and you get your results. You produce some LO observable. We really want something like this. We want a production line. We just want to say, here you go, do it all for me. And so the idea is you want automatic code to do these things. So basically, this means we want to implement these new techniques numerically. So how do we go about doing this? Well, I'm going to talk about the automatic code that I've been working on with a large number of collaborators up there. And we call this Black Hat. This is a numerical implementation of the unitary bootstrap approach, but done in C++. So, more than just this picture here, it consists of these parts, basically. The idea is, as you've seen in the talk, building blocks are basically tree amplitudes. Because of these hot shell recursion relations, there's also some fundamental rational pieces that we build up the rational terms from, and rational vertices. And the trees plug in two ways. They plug into the unitary cuts, and we can extract the constructible cut pieces in four dimensions. We're doing this in four dimensions. They also build into the odd shell recursion relation to give us the rational pieces. Combining these together, we get a one-loop amplitude. So the feature of this is because we're using compact on-shell inputs, we're going to get very nice compact answers. And in fact, it's going to be much more numerically stable than using normal Feynman diagram techniques. Because there are much fewer terms to compute and no large cancellations, it means the code is numerically stable and relatively fast at the same time.
Can you quantify those two statements? Because people do these calculations, mostly Germans. And they sit there and they just organize their Feynman diagrams correctly, and they're very good at it. And their code actually does run rather fast, and they get it right.
You can do, it tends to be stuff with the effect of bosons and stuff. It doesn't tend to be not that many jets. Mm-hmm. So the number of Feynman diagrams is much smaller when you're just using, say, quarks and vector bosons. And the more jets you have, the much harder it gets to do, because then you're involving gluons and things. And so, if you look at the processes that have been done, it's always the ones with the most people use, the ones with the most jets. Mm-hmm. And ideally, you want stuff with lots of jets or
jets. Do you have a process where you guys have calculated with your Black Hat code, and you can compare it to someone doing some totally different technique and actually put numbers to how much faster your code is, and some way, and just and quantify in some way how good your
So I've not got the, I might have some plots and hidden somewhere at the end I can show. But we do study the numerical stability, and you can see that it is numerically stable. I mean, you try and have a trade-off between numerical stability and speed.
Yeah.
And so what we found is that we've not done it ourselves, but there was a group that did the 6 kilowatt amplitude using a Feynman diagram technique. So this is Zander, Reed, Giva, and Ellis. And they basically found that to do the 6 kilowatt amplitude using Feynman diagram techniques, they needed about, I can't remember, it was 1 second or 9 seconds before. It was something the order of that. They recently, as I saw on the previous slide, done a d-dimensional unit interactive code and done the same computation again. And then they did it in, I think, 30 or 40 milliseconds. So they're running maybe 2 or 3 orders of magnitude faster. Do the same process. And it's the same people doing the coding, so you can't say one is a better coder than the other. I assume they've implemented their algorithms as best they could. And so you do get this big speed up and do the things this way.
Sorry, is the speed up really an issue? I mean, you're computing, you know, if we look at LHCs, there is a particular process. We can compute the diagrams even if it takes 5 minutes. Computing.
Yeah, but that's just one point. You don't, when you're doing this, you don't have one point. You want to say computing observable, so you're going to use a Monte Carlo to do this. You're going to throw maybe 10,000, 100,000 points. Mm-hmm. So at the tree level, you're going to throw maybe 100,000, a million points. It's normally an order of magnitude less points of one, but you don't need to observe many points. But if it takes a very long time to compute, it could take months and months and months just to do one observable.
Is that true? Are people actually calculating things that are taking months?
I don't know how long it takes. People haven't done anything. People tend to fix on the processes that they can do reasonably fast. And so obviously examples with W, I mean, this tends to be done by people like Gitmeyer and things like that, do a lot of these calculations, and they're very good at it.
Yeah.
But it's not a fast process, and they do each process by having them there to set up and then do the next one.
Another reason, this is kind of related to this, is another reason to stay away from these multi-jet amplitudes and multi-jet observables is because QCD is non-perturbative for certain momenta. And mm-hmm. It's not clear to me how your techniques basically feed into QCD factorization theorems and how we organize the calculation so that we know that there's soft physics that you can't calculate perturbatively either with your technique or any other technique.
Well, I mean, these are already really used for calculating the half piece, so we're not looking at the factorization of the soft.
But if you want to get to a physical observable, you also have to have the soft side, which is incredibly important, especially for multi-jet amplitudes.
It's a sort of separate. Basically, what we're doing is doing the same thing as you do with the Feynman diagrams. So any issues of the rest of the procedure to calculate observables is exactly the same as before. So
you're not going to be speeding that up if there's numerical issues there. In fact, that's really not numerical.
No, I mean,
it's just conceptual. There's
other issues there. We're doing our bit that we can do here. I mean, you kind of do what you can do. So we can speed this piece up, and we can put this into code. We were actually interfacing these things with, say, for example, Sherpa to do NLO observable, things like that. So for the stuff they can do using that you'd want to do with Sherpa, then we can plug stuff in and do that. And we can reuse all the techniques that have been previously used for doing all the leading order stuff. All the subtraction of the infrared singularities and things like that to compute these observables.
So yeah, but then you're stuck with the fact that these multi-jet amplitudes, one of the reasons they're not a good way to look for new physics, is that we don't understand the soft structure well at all. And so things like your curves of the star cousins are falling off depend on that. And it's not clear that these techniques will actually improve things in a way that we can actually look for new physics and things we couldn't look for before, because I mean there's still a big black box which your black hat isn't dealing with.
So you're talking about distributions of basically looking at the general shape of the distributions and the soft effects in different regions. I mean in general experimentalists don't tend to just compute the background of doing it this way, because you depend on whatever process you use for computing this way. If you get some shape, they basically prefer to compute the background by comparing, you know, basically measuring data and comparing, taking one process they know well and then relating it.
Yeah, they prefer not to compute them at all, measure them, right? Because they don't trust Monte Carlo either.
There's examples of where you can take the one loop process for. Then to take a particular background that you can measure very well, and then related to it, another background should be training a process. And you need to know a ratio factor, which you can compute using these techniques.
I think that will come purely from the hard.
Ideally you want to do things like this, yeah. I mean, there's a CNS study of using photons, relating the photons in Z amplitudes. And to produce backgrounds. I have to look up the exact reference, but
that was electroweak, though, for example.
Yeah, I mean, we stick electroweak into this. The key processes that everyone's really interested in is, say, W plus 3 jets or W plus 4 jets. That's a very useful process that people are interested in. You're not looking at just purely gluons. That's not useful. You want some electroweak and some jets. basically, blackout was first applied to all gluon processes as a testing ground. I mean, everyone does these all gluon processes because it's a nice testing ground. But in at the end of the day, you're not looking at eight gluon amplitudes. It's not, that's not useful. So when we did this, we used it on the first computation of the leading color pieces in WSTJX. And the leading color is interesting because it turns out that this is, for W plus 2 jets and W plus 1 jets, the leading color is a very dominant piece of the computation. The sub-leading color pieces in the amplitude are usually an order of magnitude smaller. And so if you want to do a quick computation, you can just use the leading color pieces because these are actually the fastest pieces to compute. The sub-leading pieces, there's more of them, and they're more complicated, so they take longer to compute. This was recently complemented by the complete computation of the whole WFIS TJET amplitude by this group of people here. They did it using their code. So they have a program called Rocket for that feature. So basically, all we're producing is numerically stable efficient computation. And the required features for the production of NLO observables and tension cross sections. So observables are the most interesting thing. And so basically, there are many more processes to come. It's just a case of plugging them into the code, which is very straightforward to do. None of the algorithms or anything changed. The algorithms are generic. So we are, as I say, not the only people doing this. There are other people computing these things. And so there's this Rocket, which I just talked about briefly, written by these people here, who have basically produced similar things to us, and it works very well. And it's the OPP people who have a program called CodeTools. And then there's an implementation using actual fiber diagrams called Golem. And they've been trying to progress using their approach. And so that's basically all the computational pieces on the market at the moment.
If you have a particular process that you're interested in, it's really important, like this one. Does that one not lend itself to analytic computation, or what are the issues?
You can, yes. I mean, you can apply, as I said, when I was going through the techniques, there's an analytic approach and a numerical approach that we use. And you can just use the analytical approach to produce the coefficients. I mean, you don't have to sit down and do it all. But it's interesting, in our recent computation of these things, we found that the analytic expressions tend to go faster, much faster than even using these new model techniques. And so you want to use as much analytic properties as possible. So it might turn out in the end that we really do want to sit down for the really important processes to use as much as possible as we can analytically and put that in.
There's nothing in principle that prevents you from doing that for any particular...
No, I mean, you can sit down and do it. It's just a case of, do you want to sit down and do it analytically for every single process you need?
Or maybe for important ones.
For important ones, mean people may sit down and do it. Yes, it's true. It just depends on basic speed of what we do. So I've gone quite quickly through this. I should have slowed down a bit, I guess. But basically, I've come to my conclusions. So I hope I've shown you that there are new methods. They're interesting nature. I basically told you about generalized unitarity or unshared recursion relations and how they're produced and how we compute things. And I've given you some examples of how we use this. For example, in the automated one-leaf amplitudes, which produce some QCD stuff that will be useful for LHC purposes. And also how you can use it for more fundamental things, like deepening our understanding of what's going on with gravitational experience. This is an area of intense interest at the moment with a lot of people working on these things. And so understanding what's going on could present very exciting new areas of physics. Basically, you can see the basic control area needs further study. Thank you.
More questions?
Yeah, there were some discussions about the relation between your calculation and the real observables that I didn't follow. So what do you guys talk about?
I have more to say.
Yeah,
more questions. So let me just get back to this PCB. So I want to understand exactly how these things help, what they can do. So can you give me an example of a QCD process you guys are actually calculating that actually was not able to be calculated before?
So this W plus 3 jets is there.
Okay, but a QCD process.
You mean purely QCD?
Well, yeah, you're talking about QCD. So
There's point two is QCD. So
okay,
so pure QCD process at all, but
a pure QCD process by itself is not really interesting. Now. Okay, so you slightly caught me out. I should have said QCD stroke electrolyte. But we basically, what I mean is, we're looking at Ws plus a large number of jets. And when I say large, any more than two, say three jets. That's something you can't really do with fine diagram. It's a very complicated process to do.
Yeah, even if you could do it, you have problems with the soft physics, right? Because if you had those jet structures will introduce soft functions, which we don't know, which we have to measure, and we're not going to be able to measure because they have to be related by some factorization theorem or something else we've already been able to measure. So it's the whole soft aspect of the QCD, which I don't see how this helps at all.
I don't think he's claiming that. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? He's saying it's different.
But he's saying it's for QCD observables, right? Well, like things like how jet functions fall off, like as an example, if
it's you get a better handle on the hard part.
That's okay. I'm okay with that. But when you actually get to an actual observable of how things fall off, you're going to depend on the soft physics as well. And to say that it's going to improve that and our ability to extract the physics from multi-jet events, I just don't get it. I think
you can make a better prediction on the cross section because you know the hard part.
You can pick the hard part better, but you still have this huge uncertainty in the soft physics, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter being able to find new physics in these observables, which is why I was at the start saying that I would stay away from these. Don't get it.
I don't know. I mean, experimenters ask for people to compute these amplitudes, so they must think that.
Yeah, but then they use like the Lund string model or something to get soft physics, and they know that that's wrong. And they know it's in particular gets worse for these multi-body final states, so the multi-jet states. So that's why they stay away from them, right?
Well, I mean,
I would like to know the exact claim as to what this is going to do for LHC physics with respect to the QCD background. I just want to know what exactly the claim is. If the claim is just the hard part is being calculated better, that's fine. I just want to know
that's all I can say, and that's all I'm confusing. I'm not talking about the soft physics. I don't work in that. I can't say anything further about that.
Okay, so about the hard physics, you also have problems if you have multiple scales, right? Because then you get pseudocop logs. So then you just don't want to just do a pure.
No, you might want to do resummations.
So can is there any hope or any ideas in how these techniques can be implemented with resummations of large logs, which are necessary?
Well, you can do everything with this. If this is just replacing the bit you normally do with a fiber diagram. So in the same way as you have regions where you want to use resummation computation, you can plug that in here as well. It's not doing anything that's different to what you do with Feynman diagrams. Yeah. It's just doing it in a better way so we get the answers out quicker. That's basically the state. So anything you can do with resummation is exactly the same as you can do with normal things with resummation.
So I remember initially a lot of these calculations were not done with mass scales because of just technicalities.
The procedure works. It's just more. You just have to put it in and do it. It's slightly more complicated, but it's exactly the same procedure. For putting masses in the rocket program has masses.
Any more questions?
Well, so okay. So, could you please explain? So what you're talking about?
When you have jet events, multi-jet events.
Okay.
What you do in QCD is you have usually a factorization theorem, but you can calculate computation speed. But then there's other things you can't calculate. You just have soft functions, which you then convolute with what you're calculating in the hard perturbed current.
Okay.
And these things cannot be calculated, they're not perturbed. And they affect the shape of the events and how the events fall off with the room. They basically affect things and how they fall off with energy. And they have a large effect, just as large an effect as the hard scattering kernel that you're improving here. So that's one of the reasons you want to stay away from these multi-jet events at LHC, because we don't understand that soft physics very well at all. And the only thing we can do is basically go and measure it somewhere. You can never measure it at LHC, it's just too pure.
So the point is that we can say focus on can people focus on the events of a small number of jets that are symmetric?
You don't want any jets, ideally.
So like this W to three jets, that's for basically for because the Higgs decays in two W's and then for the W.
Yeah, it's true. They're looking to reconstruct basically the underlying piece, but that's what's important. Right, they're not using it for any other search study.
No, I mean
this is for Higgs discovery stuff.
this each list. Basically, this each wish list by it's made up by experimental people asking for various processes, and these are what they're interested in. And basically, it tells you what their background is based on for what.
These are all for reconstructing Kink's discovery, you know, like yes, CPF yeah. and doing Kink's discovery, which is fine, but basically, they don't want that many. You don't want many jets. It's just really bad. They just don't know how to do it.
And also, there's okay. So, you explained how to extract city coefficients for the box and bubble and triangle. But I didn't quite follow. So, in the first place, how do you cut a one loop diagram into those simple bases?
Oh, you mean where that basis comes from?
Right, or just how to cut a one loop diagram?
Oh, how do you cut a diagram? I mean, so the basic way you do a curve. Is basically what I said. You do together charges. You have L plus some new processes. So whenever your amplitude is scale, you just have these L that correspond to the amplitude one, amplitude two. These are the L legs. These are the external legs.
Right.
And whatever your expression tree is here, you just put it in here, and the expression tree is here, you put it in there. And that gives you something in terms of L's. And the idea is that you then look at the structure of these L's. So you might have L squared or some propagator or something like that. And you can say, okay, I want the pieces that look like 1 over L, some propagator. These are going to correspond to, say, triangles. So I want whatever the number in front of this is. And basically, you're basically trying to extract that information from this curve. Because this contains obviously more than just this. And so this is where this basis comes in is important, because that means you know what all the basic structures are. So if you can rewrite your curves in terms of these basis integer structures, you found all the coefficients you need.
As you are saying, so basically for the triangle, the bubble, and the box, they all have different dependence on L, and then just by analyzing the L dependence, you can speed up.
Yeah, so I mean, all the techniques I discussed are a way of doing this.
Thanks. And also just, I mean, I don't want to keep everyone here, but that is a very naive questions. So just in the known events that have been already measured by some Hadron colliders, how do the one-loop calculation say, compare to the known background? I mean, just do you see that they really just say match it up? Say match it up in the, I mean, in the events that there are not say too much interference by the soft physics.
You mean does the background actually match the
right?
So
what's the matter?
You can look at the W plus 1J and the W plus 2J, and you can see that the NLO computation exactly matches what you get for an experiment after you've played around with your formal power as well. But if you look at, say, the normal things the experiment can use, like Pitya or Erwick to compute these things, then they don't match. Mm-hmm. So you can see that the NLO computation will actually give you the information that you're after. And it's useful because it doesn't match what you get from an experiment.
What people always do is they just tune their Monte Carlos to make it fit.
It's really bad. Why people need the Monte Carlo in the first place?
If you want to understand the background, okay, you want to have a predicted background.
Okay.
It's just an approximation for some people. They seem to tune. Basically, they put in fudge factors to make it.
That's for
to make it work.
For the quantum for the quantum distribution function, or for just
parameters in the model yeah. that they use that they tune. So there's different tunes, and they sort of work in some cases, but it's not a good situation. Right. It's all they can do.
Okay.
It's not just anything like PDS.
Okay.
It's much worse than that.
I see.
not an exact thing. And Monte Carlo is not an exact thing at all. It's an approximation.
Okay.
Which is what makes it dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous.
Because, yeah, it's always tricky. So.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Thanks. I probably have more questions to ask you later.
More questions? Not okay. Let's have Darren again.